Hey, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Indie Film Cafe. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody. If it sounds different, I don't have my microphone, but I'm on my cell phone, which apparently has good audio. I did not know that. But anyway, I'm here with the awesome co-host from Virginia here, Paul Prezenza. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing moveless, and we seem to be having a few technical difficulties that would make Ed Wood proud.
Probably. I know. You know, and we're going to introduce a new theme song for Paul so that Paul can be happy.
Oh, it's a coming. It's a coming.
It's coming. All right, good. And then we also have a special guest. You heard her little voice over there, Rebecca Reinhart, who is hosting this event for us.
Today. I am. I now have the power. I'm hosting this Zoom call.
She's the hostess with the mostest.
Right. And yeah, I would make a joke. I'd make an Ed Wood joke, but I just don't have any right now. Like I would say something about, you know, styrofoam gravestones. But, you know, this movie, I'm going to speak very highly of.
So oh, we all were.
Your wood is kind of pulpy and soft. Is that what you're saying?
No, my wood is standing hard and strong and tall.
wait,
this isn't sexploitation, please cast.
I know, seriously.
Let's... All right, well, make like a tree and leave those comments behind.
All right, so we're going to be talking, because as we kind of talked a little bit, we're going to be talking about Edward D. Wood Jr.'s Bride of the Monster tonight.
Yay.
I'm really excited because this is my favorite Ed Wood movie, and we'll find out why and everything, and some more information. But before that, we've got some
Moon
music. And we are back. And, thank you so much, Rebecca, for hosting us, because this was a mess up and everything, so
See, the people, you need to cut that out. The people don't know that we had any kind of technical issues. They don't need to know.
Right. I always like to leave that shit in there, you know. Yeah. let people know that kind of shit, because, you know, stuff happens.
But yeah, right. happens. We're real like that.
Yeah, like 15, 20 minutes later, we're doing this podcast, goddammit.
We're going to figure it out. We're going to figure out what we have to do it. I'm doing it in my living room, and, you know, it's not, or my parents' living room. And so, you know, I'm here back in Virginia hosting this podcast, so this is awesome. And we'll get to more information about other things happening in Virginia later. But for now, let's talk about this film, which, okay, so, you know, if you watch the movie Ed Wood, you sort of know a little backstory of it and stuff. And I think some of it was a little changed for Hollywood kind of stuff or whatever. But all in all, from what I've read and what I've researched, like a lot of that is actually true. A lot of what happened, you know.
I'd like to point out, too, that Bride of the Monster was not the original name. It had several names prior to this. It was Bride of the Atom, which actually made sense because at one point, that's what he calls Loretta King's character. And then before that, it was Monster of the Marshes. And then it was originally actually written by Alex Gordon in 1953 as the Atomic Monster. And then Ed Wood came in and they had gotten together because Alex Gordon was a friend actually previously of Bela Lugosi, and they had met through each other and they decided to work together as this would be a feature for Bela Lugosi. And then that's when Ed Wood started to sort of bring his little octopus tentacles into the story and had it changed around. And then you can see that there are various vestiges from the various previous incarnations of the script sort of leaching its way over, the idea that there being an atomic monster, B, this monster in the marshes, because it didn't really necessarily have to be there, but it was part of that script that came over. And then of course Bride of the Atom, so that, like in Ed Wood, where he talks about, you know, atomic age stuff. And then finally its final incarnation as the Bride of the Monster. And then, because it's funny, it always struck me about that title, because it's like, which monster are they talking about? The octopus? Varnoff? Tor Johnson? She could be anyone's bride.
Well, maybe that was it. Maybe that's why they called it Bride of the Monster, because there was like three different monsters in the film, you know?
I think you're putting too much into it.
Yeah, that's putting a little too much into that.
I think Bride of the Monster brought it back to more of what he was trying to emulate, like, you know, like, kind of a universal monster movie, and I think that's...
Your mic's a little low.
Yeah, I was going to say, we can barely hear you there.
Can you hear me now?
I mean, we can hear you, but you need to, somehow or another, you need to... And we're not seeing you. Can you put it in gallery?
There you are.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. My mic must be screwing up. Okay. We have so many difficulties.
I know. All
right, so I'm just going to use my computer now.
Can you put this in like a gallery mode since you're the host so that we can all see each other?
I'm in gallery mode.
Yeah. You have to swipe to the left on your phone. Just swipe to the left.
Okay. I like that. All right.
Look at this. Look at us. This needs to be cut.
No, hell no. I'm leaving this shit in here.
There we go. We're all learning new things about Zoom and all kinds of stuff.
I'm learning.
So,
hey, if it weren't for Paul, we wouldn't be doing Zoom. Thank you, Paul. No, he's the one who brought it up.
So I don't know as much probably about the backstories. I'm sure, like, definitely Paul knows about Wood, but I always got the impression, like, after watching Ed Wood, the movie Ed Wood, and like watching his movies, that they chose Bride of the Monster to be like sort of the backdrop of that movie. But I feel like most of like the foibles and things like probably happened more like on Plan 9 or like Glenn or Glenda. Like, this movie seems pretty polished.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that, like, you know, it's like they chose this one, I'm sure, because Bela Lugosi was still, you know, around and all that jazz. But I feel like maybe they melded some things together.
Yeah. My personal feeling is that Ed Wood and his folks that wanted to back him, whoever they might have been, wanted to make a hit film, and they wanted to do what was the big thing at the time, which was atomic monster movies. And I think Ed Wood really wanted to do a throwback, because I think he pretty much saw Lugosi in his old 30s and 40s roles. Because to me, this movie always feels like it was made 15 years too late. Like, this was an old 40s Monogram or Republic kind of film. You know, like, I don't want to say The Black Cat, but I forget some of the later 40s stinky Lugosi films. That's what this kind of reminds me of, that style.
Yeah, you know, even Voronoff does the whole, like, Dracula bit of, like, all that. And I love that. Like, I love seeing it, because you could tell that Ed had a love for Lugosi's old films, and putting him in there and making him do all these crazy things, especially for a guy his age at that time. Like, oh my goodness, he wasn't picking up he wasn't picking up Janet Lawton, but you could tell that was obviously a stunt person doing that. But, you know, it was nice that, like, they had him running around whipping Tor and just, I mean, he was all game for it.
And reportedly delivering his lines like a freaking champ.
Oh yeah. That there's a story I remember reading about that came from Paul Conrad, who said that Wood was really concerned about Bela Lugosi on that particular, that one scene where he's talking to the other professor. And he said that he prepared cue cards, and Lugosi refused to use the cue cards. And Wood only wanted to do one take because they didn't really have extra film. So he was very, very, very concerned about it. But Lugosi insisted that he could do it all in one take, and he did. And it's one of the wonderful things that pops out in Ed Wood is, you know, at the end, you know, he does this great thing. Everybody's stunned. And then at the end of the scene, when he goes cut, everybody's like, woohoo, what a great job. So, you know, I like this particular film because it really does show that Bela Lugosi used to be a top-notch actor. Now he was a stage actor. He was, you know, your old, you know, 1910s vaudeville, 1920s style actor. But with the right director, he could have a great performance, which is why he's so good in the Todd Browning's Dracula, you know, and then why he seems very stagey and melodramatic in some of the later movies that he ends up doing, because he's just, you know, he's with a lot of other directors who just don't really know how to utilize him properly.
Hey, that's, you know, honestly, that's today too. You know, sure. You yes. have a lot of things, it's like fantastic actors who are great if the right director is around them, you know, but yeah. sometimes the wrong director just doesn't know how to reel that person in, mm-hmm. and then just become stagey or not that very
good. And you look back, like, even, okay, let's say like 70s actors who maybe were brought back in like the 90s, and that's like John Travolta even. You know, he mm-hmm. was totally washed up, but then like there was a director who handpicked him, who like got his style and brought him back. Like, I mean, I think now we can look at it and be like, this is a really good Bela Lugosi movie. You could see back in 55 where people are like, Bela Lugosi, he is all washed up.
Right.
You know what? I wish that Ed Wood was alive today and directing Gary Busey. Like, could you imagine an Ed Wood, awesome. Gary Busey movie?
I don't know that Gary Busey's directable anymore.
Well, no, you no, just kind of wind him up and let him go. I mean, that's really what you do.
Yeah.
So Moody, for the benefit of those folks out there who have not seen Bride of the Monster, do you think you can give like a quick encapsulation of the plot?
All right. Well, a quick one. All right. Let's see. And basically it's about a woman named Jen Lawton who wants to know a little bit more about what's going on at Lake Marsh. So she basically gets a group, you know, she goes out to investigate herself and gets kidnapped by Dr. Eric Voronoff. Meanwhile, her boyfriend, Lieutenant Dick Craig, is out looking for her and stumbles across her car and then ends up getting his cop friends and going out and they try to find him. There's a lot. I don't think there's a quick way to sum this movie up, I guess. Just... Yeah.
Can I say that one of the things that I've always loved about this movie is that the Lawson girl, as everybody likes to call her, she is a hardcore plucky journalist who will not give up.
Right.
Like, right. In a time when, like, you know, it was all like, you know, the Steno girl or whatever, like, he puts a character in there who's a super strong-willed, like, female character, and she's just like, fuck you guys. You won't tell me what I want to know. I'm going to the swamp in my pencil skirt and like white sweater, you know?
She's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, she is. She is, but she's also, again, she's going to do it herself, you know? And she doesn't wait for the boys. And I always really just like that character, because for that time especially, it was really uncharacteristic.
Sure.
She and like even the newspaper lady in the basement, like the archivist or whatever, because she's like a total like smart ass to anybody that walks in there. And like, you know, like they are very, very break the female mold of that time.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I mean, if you notice, the movie has a lot of jokes. Like everybody has some kind of like one liner to each other, you know? Even Captain Robbins likes to say little jabs at Kelton or you know, or Dick, you know, and everything. So it's sort of like, I like that. Like, I liked Ed Wood's humor, and I think that's what, because I feel like, honestly, a lot of people talk about Plan 9 a lot, you know. That seems to be like the movie that everybody, like, whenever they talk about Ed Wood, they talk about that movie. And it kind of bothers me because I never really liked Plan 9 that much. Like, I thought it was okay, and I can understand why people, whatever, but like Bride of the Monster just had more fun to it, you know. Well, my opinion.
Plan 9 is, I think, a lot more fun as being a stinker, but
right.
Bride of the Monster is a better film, and a lot mm-hmm. of people consider this to be Ed Wood's best film. I mean, you know.
And it was his only financially successful one.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty low bar. But, you know, it actually has a coherent story and it makes sense. Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it was co-written by Alex Gordon, frankly. But, you know,
I don't think it was. I've looked it up. I've researched it. None of his actual stuff was in it, is in the movie. So Alex Gordon may have had like the story idea, but his script was like, this was totally Ed Wood's.
Yeah, the screenplay was written by Ed Wood, although it is based on an Alex Gordon script.
Yeah, so I think, yeah.
So we need to give Ed some props. Because I'm sorry, because like, you know, having been like, I made a post when I was watching this on a couple different groups the other night. I said, I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older or because I've been involved in so many low budget productions, but like, I don't think that Ed Wood was a bad filmmaker. And I think this movie was good. And I did think it was good before. Like, I didn't quite understand. Like, I can understand Plan 9. You could kind of see, you know, some of the schlocky things, and you know that, like, you know, all the Bela Lugosi stuff was shot for a different movie and he was dead and all that stuff. But like, this seemed like a very legit movie. Like, I thought it, I always thought, even back in the like, oh, let's make fun of Ed Wood days, I thought this was great.
Yeah, it's, again, the bar is pretty low. I mean, we're talking his two previous, I mean, his other movies that he's famous for, Glenn or Glenda and Plan 9, pretty much everything could possibly go wrong and be bad was. You know, in this movie, it's more like maybe half of the things there are bad. The other half are decent considering the budget.
But no worse than other movies of the time.
No, no.
That's nothing, my point.
Right. This is no worse than, say, anything from, say, you know, William One-Shot Bodine or some of the other guys who were pulling out, you know, cheapy, crappy, you know, low-budget movies of the period. So, yeah. And I have always said, you know, people who look at Ed Wood and say he's the worst director of all time, no. There are much,
they
much
have not watched very many movies.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, and we have to give it to the Medveds, though, because they are the ones who actually gave him the moniker, you know, of them. And those are the guys who did the Golden Turkey Awards. And, you know, if it weren't for them, I feel like a lot of these movies wouldn't, like, people wouldn't have the same, like, love for them necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Because it became a thing.
Right.
You know
the
what I mean?
The Turkey Awards led to Joe Bob Briggs, which led to Mystery Science Theater, which led to, you know, all the other stuff that sort of built up. You know, the Golden Turkeys is really kind of where it started, because I remember when it first came out, I got it when that book first hit the shelves, and that's kind of where it started for me, because I had already loved all that stuff from when I was a kid, and I was watching that stuff, and for me, it was just amazing that somebody out there other than myself knew about these movies and loved them, and hey, this is the stuff I watched every Saturday morning.
And that's exactly it, the validation. Like, oh, I'm not a complete idiot for liking this. I'm not the only one. I think, especially with the age of the internet, we know now we're not the only ones. And it just, it makes it so much more valid. And it's kind of sad, because you feel like what have you said, like, I wish Ed Wood were alive today. Not to direct Gary Busey, but to see that, like, people appreciate, like, how much heart and soul he put into stuff.
Yeah.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, but there's a lot of good, fun Ed Wood touches that in this film that are pretty typical of Ed Wood's style that I love, that you're not going to see anywhere else. Like, you know, Harvey B. Dunn, who's one of my favorite character actors. He's in a few of Ed Wood movies. He's like Teenagers from Outer Space. You realize that little bird that he had on his shoulder is his bird?
I figured it had to be the way that
he was a clown for a while, and part of his act was he incorporated this parakeet. And so I can just see him saying to Ed Wood, can I bring my parakeet on as part of the movie? And Ed Wood's like, sure, bring it on. How many other directors would do that? Come on.
Well, yeah. I mean, it also, for a low budget, that adds like a little bit of, Production value. That's what I was looking for.
So
there you go. Like, I love it.
I was doing location scouting today for my next movie, and it's going to be at a camp, a Boy Scout camp. So I'm going to have to ask my actors to, like, sleep on, like, freaking Boy Scout cots and everything. But The guy that runs it is the chief of the volunteer fire department in this tiny little town. He's like, so if you want, like, I mean, I've got fire trucks, I can bring fire trucks. And I was like, number one rule of low budget filmmaking, if somebody offers you something that has production value, you will write a scene that will use said fire trucks. Yes, I will take your fire trucks.
And
you just do.
Well, yeah, that goes to the whole with Robert Rodriguez's line of like he had a, you know, a turtle, like a guitar case, and I forgot what a gun or something. You know, like okay, let's go make a movie out of this.
You know? Right, you use what you have and whatever makes elevates your movie a little bit, because the bird is a cute little thing, and like when he gets the glass of water in the water and he puts it out there for the bird, I mean that's adorable. You know?
Right. And it's the kind of thing you're not going to see in very many other movies, but Ed Wood is a good chance.
Yeah, it was a, every time I see the bird though, I think of Mystery Science Theater, because there was a, they did Bride of the Monster and they were like, give the bird a kiss. Every time I see it, that's all I want to say is give the bird a kiss.
See, and I wondered, Rebecca, with regards to what you just said, as far as things like the dress. Because clearly she does not go in there. Janet Lawton does not go in there with a bride's dress. So A, Bela Lugosi's character has to have one. And then it's like, he puts it on and like, okay, I guess she's wearing a bride's dress because the movie is called Bride of the Monster. But was he really planning this the whole time? He's got to have a bride. And again, for who? And it's just the whole bride thing. It's there because they had the dress and they stuck her in it. That's why.
Yeah, and because it fit her, or she had it. Like, she's just like, I'm getting, she's probably like, you know what, dude, I'm just like ditching my husband right now. I got this dress. You want me to like wear it for something? And we're calling it Bride of the Monster.
Exactly. I've got a false arm. We're using it.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, they were always, I think, going to call it Bride of the Atom. So they, you know, which is funny because you look at like what Bride of Frankenstein and all the other bride movies, you know, like what, you know, like they, and not all of them wear like bride's dresses, you know.
Right. But I mean, at least in Bride of the Monster and Bride of the Frankenstein, that was the whole point of the movie, was to make a bride for Frankenstein. That's not really what's going on in this. He's supposed to be making a race of superhumans to go back and take over and conquer the world. This whole bride thing is like a side thing that's kind of weird.
Which, again, it goes back to, like, this is, it felt like he was trying to emulate, like, some kind of monster, like a universal monster movie, trying to go back to Bride of Frankenstein.
Yes.
But the monster is the octopus, okay? Mm. He does not entertain the fact ever. We never hear that he's going to breed said octopus monster and woman on the slab. There's a lot of Frankenstein stuff because they put people down, like, you know, with the thing on their head and the straps over them on the table. Like, the monster, which is an octopus, a real octopus, stock footage of an octopus, is not really, like, he doesn't have anything to do with it. I'm assuming it's a he, if he's going to marry a woman, but that's okay. I'm being prejudiced.
I'm going to fight you on this one. I believe the monster is Dr. Voronoff, and I'll tell you why. Because towards the end, when Voronoff gets his comeuppance and Lobo sticks him on the table and puts the machine on him and actually turns the shit on, it works. It works on Voronoff. It failed every single time, but Voronoff comes out different. You'll notice there is a body double playing Lugosi. He comes off, he's a bigger person. That's why he's able to beat up Lobo. And you notice, if you look carefully, he's got these big old Frankenstein boots on, because like you were saying, they're trying to make him be like the Frankenstein monster from Universal. So that was the whole thing. That is the monster. That is who the bride is supposed to be for. As I see it.
Well, wait, no. Okay, no, that's a good point. I like that, but here's the problem with that, is that Voronoff was never supposed to be the monster, right? Like, he was never
he becomes a monster pretty clearly. He was always
looking for somebody else.
I am gonna kind of side with Paul on this. I didn't think about it before, but he is the most reprehensible one, sort of. Like, yeah. he gets the opportunity
to go home, and he says, no, instead, I'm going to conquer the world for myself.
And I got this hot chick in a bride's dress from Goodwill, and I'm good here.
Plus, I'm whipping poor Lobo.
Well, no, he is a monster. Like, he's a terrible person. I'm just saying, like, his plan wasn't, he was going to make his own race of people. So he was attempting it on, he was even going to attempt it on her. He was going to make her a super atomic woman, you know, which actually would have been kind of cool too if they went that route.
Right, the 50-foot woman, that would have been interesting, an interesting crossover.
Right, but they went with it because they probably couldn't find a stunt woman to do that, so they decided to go with Bella. But also, maybe you're right. I'm just thinking about it. Maybe you're right, because he does, like, when he does turn into the monster, everybody's shooting at him, and he's just this big beast, nasty thing.
Big, and you know, it's funny, in Ed Wood, you know, they keep belaboring the point of the fact that, you know, Tom, the chiropractor, is his body double in Plan 9. But the thing is, there's a lot more of a body double in this film for Lugosi than there is in Plan 9. A whole lot more.
Yeah, you barely see it in Plan 9, but you can definitely see it in this one. Because I honestly, had I not known that the chiropractor was him, you know, was his stunt double in Plan 9, I would have just assumed that was Bela Lugosi. There's just only one scene. There's only one scene in Plan 9 where he, like, accidentally, his cape falls off or whatever. You can kind of see he's not Bela Lugosi, you know?
Well, the thing about it is, they wanted the double to look much more like him in Plan 9. They just failed because they just didn't have somebody who was appropriate. Whereas in Bride of the Monster, they clearly wanted somebody who was definitely bigger, in my opinion. Because
and that's what I was going to say. It's like the Incredible Hulk TV show. Obviously, like, Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno are nowhere near the same human being. But in your mind, they were. You know, and I think it's the same thing here. Like, yeah, it had to be somebody who was bigger, stronger, whatever. It didn't need to look like Bela Lugosi. It needed to look like something that had been, like, beefed up by.
And the most wonderful thing about it, and my favorite part of the movie, is the fact that, ironically, it's Lobo who's the true hero of the movie, who ends up doing the actual science experiment properly. He keeps, you know, Varnoff keeps failing and killing all of his test subjects, but when Lobo goes and starts messing with all the shit after he puts Varnoff on there, it actually works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And that was the thing too, is, like, at the end of the movie too, if you notice, Voronoff is back to his regular size. Like, where did that come from? When he's getting attacked by the octopus.
Yeah, that's just poor editing, in my opinion.
Poor everything, because you can tell, like, if they kept it with the big giant man who's playing Bela Lugosi and kept him, you know, getting attacked, but, you know, that would have been cool, you know. But unfortunately, you know, and then it ends with the big explosion, and then, you know.
The other thing that Ed Wood movie shows is, you know, poor Bella out there wrestling with the octopus thing. And as it turns out, I did a little research, and, you know, for this movie, he did have the body double out there. It wasn't Lugosi. But the thing is that there are two other actors who don't get mentioned in Ed Wood who look equally ridiculous. The first hunter is out there thrashing around with the stupid looking octopus. And then the other professor is out there, and he looks even worse than all, thrashing around with it. And they have, like, one arm that is on a string where it's kind of going like this, and the rest is just sitting there, and they have to pretend, and it just looked bad. But from what I understand, he didn't really steal it. It was more like he rented it, they think. He just forgot to bring the motor that was supposed to, you know, make the arms move around. Or he didn't know about that there was a motor or something. And so that's what happened. And so he's like, you know, just like, you know, movies, just move the arms, thrash around, and look like it's killing you.
The only time I thought the octopus looked weird is, like, the very first time they show it, it's obviously, like, the puppet. And it's just kind of like, ew. it's not really doing a whole lot. And then they like cut to like the stock footage of like an aquarium. And then it's like, oh yeah, it's really an octopus. So when the arms came up, I really didn't think anything of it. Just one like full body, like lifeless puppet shot that I was like, yeah, you probably should have cut that out.
And then of course the problem is, you know, the juxtaposition of the puppet versus the stock footage. You know, the stock footage is clearly an octopus underwater.
Right. And doing, you know, being the graceful creature that an octopus is, not the sloppy swamp creature.
In an ocean as opposed to a marsh, a freshwater marsh.
Right, a foot of muddy water.
Yeah. It's just, you know, this is a bad film. I mean, I know what you're saying about Ed Wood. This is better for Ed Wood, but it's still
a terrible film. But it's the best he could do, you know. I think everything else that he's made, I don't know, maybe I've seen Jailbait like a couple times, you know. I've never like, it's been a long time since I watched it, but I remember that just being kind of slow and boring, you know, and not as like, you know, like exciting as this one. This one's a little bit more exciting.
Yeah, Jailbait feels like one of the shorts that they would use on Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Right.
But like a cautionary tale. Yeah.
Right. That was the transition period that you had sort of the nice, happy, optimistic, pre-alcoholic Ed Wood, although things were getting bad, to before he becomes the very much alcoholic, dark, nudie cutie, you know, porn, semi-porn Ed Wood later on. You know, Jailbait kind of straddles that transition.
Listen to Sexploitation Sleazecast, and you can hear all about Orgy of the Dead.
Absolutely. And I got more than one Ed Wood sexploitation film out there that we're going to cover at some point, so don't you worry.
You know, just wait, guys. Just wait for that one.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I really, like, I mean, this is my favorite of all his films. And I think it's because it's probably the first one that I could, like, sit through that, you know, like all the way through and really enjoy. Like, I've talked to Paul about this before, and I may have talked about this on the show, but Glenn or Glenda, for the longest time, I hated it. It just kept putting me to sleep, you know.
I love it.
Then I watched it semi-recently, like in the last couple of years, and I just adore the movie. So maybe, I don't know if Paul's changed me a little bit or something with all the shit that I have to watch, and it's actually, like, it's above that shit. Score. I don't know. Or if just my tastes have changed, period. But I actually do like Leonard Glenda a lot more. However, this is still, like, I mean, I could watch this movie all the time, and I don't fall asleep to it. I'm interested. I mean, there's always so much going on. The direction is ridiculous, but it's fun, you know? Like, I mean, the movie itself is, you know, I don't know. It's just a fun flick to me.
Well, let's face it. It's the things we already said. There are well-developed characters who have good personalities, who crack jokes, who have chemistry with each other, and there's a coherent story. You know, I mean, right there. I mean, like, Glenn or Glenda. Okay, I love that movie. Because think about at the time.
It's incoherent. Think about
the subject matter, though. You know, he was doing something. Time. Yeah, like, I mean, yeah, but I mean, you know, he's like trying to tackle like a really, really sensitive subject.
An autobiographical one.
And he sucks at it. That to me is like the Ed Wood, like the sucky Ed Wood, like the enjoyable sucky Ed Wood right there. Like, you know, right. When somebody just tries to, you guys have probably, I know you've heard of it, The Day the Clown Cried, I think is what it's called, Jerry Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so like Harry Shearer is one of the few people who've seen that, and what he likened it to, he says, it's like if you went down to Tijuana and you saw a black velvet painting of Auschwitz. That's what it's like. And that's exactly what Glenn or Glenda's like. You take this serious subject and it's just done so terribly.
I got to see that movie once. It came to State Theater in Newark when I was in college. And it was just such a weird oddity. And yeah, I believe me, it is one I have been searching and searching and searching, and I cannot get a copy of it. I'm pretty sure Jerry Lewis made sure that nobody could get a copy.
It's available in 2024. His estate gave, it's not complete. The print got sent to the Library of Congress, and 2024 is when it's released, but somebody has released like the first 36 minutes.
Yeah, there's like a bootleg of it out there. That's what I saw.
Yeah, and that's right. Yeah, and it's like subtitled because it's like it was spoken in English, but presumably subtitled in German. But then this one's dubbed in German, but subtitled in English.
Yeah, it's a fail with a capital F. But, you know, one thing about this particular film I also wanted to bring up is, of course, this is the very first in what they call the Kelton trilogy. Yep. This is Kelton's first appearance, and certainly not his last. And I think it's interesting because, you know, it does establish him as this sort of comic foil and sort of bumbling, incompetent cop. But initially, he's kind of more of a suck up, kind of an irritating suck up. You know, he's like taking the newspapers from the newspaper guy and, oh, I'll be the one to take it into the chief and, you know, just kind of being annoying. And fortunately, he grows as a character over the course of the next couple of movies, Night of the Ghouls and Plan 9, to, okay, maybe he's a little bit more of a comic character, but he's a lot more lovable in those two movies, if you ask me.
You know, we all grow. We all grow. And so did Kelton.
Yeah. He sort of became his own character. Like in the beginning, I really like, there's a line in the movie that I didn't remember, but when I was watching it tonight, I was like, huh. They get to the house, they get to the old Willow's place, and the cops are like, hey, Kelton, this is your first time out. So, you know, be careful here or whatever, right? And I was like thinking, oh my God, this is Kelton's first outing, you know, like later in Plan 9, he comes out with Patrolman Larry and, you know, and he's like dealing with all the aliens or whatever, but this is his first time and he sees a monster. Like, I mean, to me, that was sort of a cool, like little thing, you know, the beginning of something. And then later on, and we've talked about Night of the Ghouls in our first season. And I think it was the first season. Yeah. We talked about Night of the Ghouls, and Night of the Ghouls was the last of the Kelton movies, and it definitely, you could see sort of where they were taking Kelton. I'm sad that he didn't come back for Sinister Urge, but they did replace him with Klein. You know, they went from Kelton to Klein, and it would have been kind of cool if they continued a series of Kelton movies, which right. John Johnson has done.
Right, right. And Kelton, Paul Marco did appear as Kelton, the patrolman, in a few other later movies, I think in the 70s and 80s, I think he managed to get in there. The other thing I wanted to point out, and I don't know whether you know about this or not, Moody, but the actor, George Beckwar, he plays Professor Strowski. I don't know whether you knew this, but he actually was somebody that Ed Wood wanted to use a lot more. He had plans to use him in other things, but as it turned out, Beckwar did not have a very good experience on set, and he complained a lot about the substandard way that it was done, to such a point that Ed Wood was like, well, fine, don't work with me anymore.
Yep.
And that's what happened. And I think he ended up, you know, being on a few TV episodes later on, but that was pretty much it.
That is correct. I read that in the in Nightmare of Ecstasy. They actually talk about it. He wanted to work with George Beckwar, and he's excited, and then just things kind of didn't work out. They didn't like each other, you know, I guess. I'm just gonna say, like, Ed Wood at that time probably wasn't the easiest director to work with, in a way.
Like, probably not. No,
I would say that maybe like a established actor other than Bela Lugosi, who was, I believe, on heroin at the time or whatever, on drugs at the time, was, that's how he was coping with working with Ed Wood. You know, like these more talented people just kind of like they were just like, okay, this is a little incompetent. You know, these guys don't know really what they're doing. He probably, like, I could see Ed going, you know, doing all the stuff that they said in the movie Ed Wood, where you bump into something and like, oh, let's just keep going. You know, who cares?
Because Beckwar actually does a pretty good performance.
He does a great performance.
And, he does.
You know, and then the same thing I also want to point out about Tony McCoy. Tony McCoy, of course, is famous because his father, Donald, ended up bankrolling the film when the rent didn't have enough money because Loretta King didn't have the money she insinuated that she had. So he had to do this. And so and famously, he said, okay, but my son's got to be the lead and there's got to be an atomic explosion at the end. And of course, both of those things happen. But Tony McCoy does a pretty decent job for an amateur who had no experience. I didn't think he was that bad. I mean, he wasn't great, but you know, he doesn't do like a wooden, you know, delivery. Yeah. He's one of the better performances.
No pun intended.
Right. You know, I wasn't particularly thrilled with Loretta King or Dolores Fuller. Even Tor Johnson just seems kind of
Tor Johnson is just, I mean, he is the one that, like, in any Ed Wood movie, I mean, he is just, he's not an actor. He's a caricature. And he is the one thing that in this movie, if he would have replaced him with somebody who would have been a better character actor, I think this movie would have been elevated, like, severely.
Maybe, but, like, what I, pretty much they just gave him, like, he was just a wrestler in that movie. You know, like, he has no lines. He like, grrs, you know, or whatever.
Right,
like,
right.
Just, right, but know. He is still, like, I mean, he's still, you can tell he's just like, oh, what do I do? Right.
He's always got his arms up. I'm like, dude, why are your arms up all the time? He's on his tiptoes because you're right, he's a wrestler. That's what they're trained to do, is to be ready to pounce on things.
There could be an actor who would be able to be, like, you know, towering thing without any kind of lines and actually make it believable. He was just a big dude.
Yeah, so Ed, you know, put him in there because, you know, I mean, they needed a really big dude to play that role. I don't know if they had any lines for him at all, but in, you know, Plan 9, they gave him lines.
Yes.
And they were terrible, like, delivered awful. Like, you couldn't understand a word he was saying.
Right.
So, like, I'm glad he didn't give him the lines.
I will defend Tor Johnson in Plan 9. You know, I think the delivery wasn't so bad. It was really the you know, very thick accent that he always had. I think that was kind of the problem. But as far as the way he moved and the way that he presented himself, the way he walked and everything, he was a lot more believable as a police or homicide detective in that film than he was as a monster petting this little piece of fabric and always running around with his arms up in the air. I mean, to me, it just wasn't a very good, believable performance. And he does a much better job. And as a matter of fact, even though he's in some other pretty terrible movies and he has a limited range, he's really not that horrible, considering the fact that, you're right, the reason he's in the first place is because he's big and bald and freaky looking.
Right. And he actually, you know, what was cool was, like, he's the only one of all the Ed Wood people to actually get a mask made out of him.
Right.
Like, they made a Tor Johnson mask. And so he did Lobo in this one, but then he played Lobo again in Night of the Ghouls, but he also played it in the movie Unearthly, starring John Carradine, which is just strange. And Lobo spoke, which he did not do in any of the Ed Wood movies, but he spoke in Unearthly with the most famous line of "Time for go to bed," you know, right? Which I love. I absolutely love that line. Like, but yeah,
he's also in 1941 Shadow of the Thin Man, where he's playing a wrestler, but he's got a head full of hair, and it's so weird to see him.
Oh my god,
a full head of hair! It's just like, what? It's just too strange.
And he was on Groucho Marx's "You Bet Your Life," you know. So he has the line in, or whatever. Have you guys seen that? The Your Betcha Life thing where like Groucho Marx is actually just making fun of Tor Johnson. It's like, you Tor Johnson? Why? You know? Because he's like, no, I Tor Johnson. He's like, oh, that's your name. Okay. You know, like joking on the dude. And I'm just like, see, Tor was like a way more famous than, you know, like a lot of people give him credit for, you know?
Sure. In the 50s and 40s and 50s, definitely. You know, it's kind of like if you had gotten, well, I mean, maybe not Andre the Giant huge, but he was in the ballpark, you know?
Oh, yeah. I don't think we could have seen him in The Princess Bride, though.
No, but God, I would have loved to have seen that. Oh, my God.
But Edward was like a lot of the, quote unquote, schlock directors of the time who picked up people who were like B-level celebrities or washed up celebrities, and he brought them back. And there's something really admirable about that to me.
I don't know if he really brought them back. He brought them to his movies, but they didn't really go on.
Well, but like Bela Lugosi, I think, was one that was like nobody was going to hire him.
But, yeah, people actually really did think he was dead. Like that was not like just a joke.
Although it must be said that in the movie Ed Wood, they did take some liberties there. Like, for example, they ignore the fact that he was remarried. He wasn't really destitute. He was doing some work. He wasn't in films. He was doing stage stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know, they don't show like his son, and they don't show a whole lot of other stuff in order, I think, to make him seem more pathetic. But in actuality, he really kind of wasn't. He was just simply not showing up as a movie star in films anymore.
He was washed up in Hollywood.
Right. Although he was in, I think, 1951 and 1952, he was in a couple of smaller things where they were just kind of like, okay, well, you can be the spooky Dracula guy. I think like the Abbott and Costello kind of shit. But he wasn't having any more serious roles. And it wasn't until his last actual role with actually Tor Johnson, the Black Sleep, where that's his final role. But he's unable to memorize any of his lines, just like kind of Edward was afraid of, but it actually came to pass. And so they actually had to make his character mute to cover that part up. And so Bride of the Monster is considered Bela Lugosi's last vocal performance where he actually speaks.
I totally agree. Yeah. And he did a great job. Like in, I actually liked him in The Black Sleep too. I watched that movie. I think it was on like YouTube or something. I watched it. I was like, wow, this is actually really, you know.
It's better than I expected it to be.
Yeah. Unearthly was terrible. And it's definitely that's a Misty movie for sure. You know, but it, Unearthly was, you know, but once again, that was one of the only other ones like other than Beast of Yucca Flats where they used Tor.
I thought Bella was pretty good in this film, especially with that wonderful famous set of lines where he's talking about the jungle is my home and all mm-hmm. that was really cool. You know, it's out of place, but I do like the whole, you know, hypnotism thing where he's doing
right
his hand, and then he does the thing where he's doing it from afar and he puts his hands together and all of a sudden she's sleepwalking, you know, because he can control her mind and all that.
You're tired.
Right.
No, you're tired. What? You're tired. Oh, that's very strange. Suddenly feel tired.
So Ed Wood was making good of all that stuff that was great in the 30s. It's just, it was 1955.
Exactly. Know?
But to us now, it is, I mean, it's a really good send-off, I think, for Bela Lugosi. I know it wasn't his last role, but it was his last, like, the last hurrah. And mm-hmm. I think it was a really good one for, like, somebody who had been the person that he was, the actor that he was.
The real shame of it, of course, is that right after this movie, they had planned to do The Ghoul Goes West, which was been another Bela Lugosi film, and they started filming parts of it, and then it, you know, unfortunately, he got very sick, and then that was pretty much it.
And they were going to film Vampire's Tomb. Actually, some of Plan 9 are both Ghoul Goes West and Vampire's Tomb, if I'm correct. So some of that, because with the vampire stuff is definitely vampire, you know.
I was going to say, all of his stuff that's in Plan 9, where it is Bela Lugosi, is Vampire's Tomb, from what I've heard. I don't know. Yeah. I might be wrong.
Now, I don't know whether you guys know this, but I have a movie called The Vampire's Tomb, which is supposedly based on the Ed Wood movie that never got made. So I'll have to share that with you guys sometime.
Well, I don't, because I've heard about that. That was also on YouTube. You can find that on YouTube. However, I don't know if that's actually based on the real script or they just made their own script
It's debated back and forth. Supposedly it's inspired by, loosely based on, that kind of thing.
Yeah, because and I don't really want to see that kind of thing unless it's the actual, like, because somebody actually made a movie that starred Billy Zane, of all people, and Kristen Ritchie, and a bunch of other big name people are in this movie. And it was filmed exactly the way that Ed Wood wanted it to, because Kathy Wood said she would not give the script out. It was called I Woke Up Early the Day I Died.
Oh, yeah, and I've heard about this.
Yeah, and I watched it. It was on YouTube for a while until they took it down. I don't know if that was copyright reasons or if that was whatever, but I saw some of it. It was terrible. but it was made terribly on purpose, you know, like, right. It was done exactly the way that Ed Wood had wanted it. Silent. It was just ridiculous. It was filmed in color. Like, I mean, all the things he wanted to do that unfortunately did not happen the way that he wanted it to. So, you know, they made it, but I sort of want to see that, you know. But I'm telling you, like, Billy Zane, Christina Ricci, tons of crazy, like, famous actors, all having, like, bit parts where I think Billy Zane was the only one who was, like, the lead. Everybody else was just random people he ran across.
A couple other things I kind of wanted to point out about this film that I love. I love the crappy sets. The sets are terrible. The sets are one of the biggest problems for this film. You know, first of all, when they're outside looking at the house, it's clearly a flat, you know, and then they go in that first door and there's like a staircase to the left, but there can't be, because if you're going in the front door, then there should be nothing. It should be nothing there. So clearly they didn't care what sets they were using, which is a problem. And then, of course, the laboratory, you've noticed in the back, there's a kitchen with a sink and a fridge. And then the quote unquote ray, atomic ray, that's just a photo enlarger on a boom mic stand. That's all it is. I had a similar enlarger I was in high school.
Hey, you know what? Don't knock it. Okay.
Oh, man.
It's believable.
Look closely, you can see the painted sets of the brick in the background.
You don't have to look closely, actually, on that one. Yeah. It looks like a bad haunted house for toddlers. It really does.
Yeah, it's not good. You know.
Nope. But,
and of course we've talked about the ridiculous octopus. Typical overuse of stock footage, like the gators in the quote unquote swamp when what's his face is going in and he decides he's going to shoot all the alligators.
What about the snake? The random snake that comes or whatever, but you know, obviously she wasn't in any danger from like a rubber snake or whatever it ended up being, you know.
Yeah,
from
Tor just kind of goes, rah!
Yeah, just goes, rah! You know, and knocks it down and then takes her away.
That's what you do when you're Tor.
Yeah, I mean, Tor can get away with it, you know.
Yeah,
of all the people there. I don't know, rewatching this movie just put a smile on my face. I don't know, like I said, you know, it's just one of those films that, like, every time I watch it, you know, it just makes me happy, you know, because, like, I can definitely see the art of indie filmmaking in this film, you know, like, I can see what they did to just get this movie made. You know what I mean? Back then it was probably more of a bigger deal than
it was huge, because now everybody can make a movie. We all have phones. We all have a party city where we can go get fake blood, blah, blah, blah. Like, I mean, but just to take it to a very basic level, they had to shoot on film. And film was expensive. No matter if you had no other costs whatsoever for sets, actors, whatever, film was expensive and you had to get it processed. And we don't have that now. Like now it's like, if you've got an iPhone and maybe, you know, you're good. And so I think that's one of the things that people overlook with like independent films or like, you know, low budget films from the past is, you know, you'll hear like, oh, this had a $50,000 budget. Well, it's like, oh yeah, probably $40,000 went to the film and the camera rental and the film processing. Like it's a totally different beast, you know?
And the thing is too, you know, people don't, unless you watch all the Ed Wood movies, they're not going to understand that just because there's a lack of budget and just because there's, you know, a certain level of stinkiness involved in most of his films doesn't necessarily make that an Ed Wood film. What makes it an Ed Wood film is the weird, bizarre little touches that he puts into just about all his movies, like the bird being in there for no other real reason, like the fact that Lobo's obsessed over Angora and is you know, petting the little swatch of fabric all the time, you know, like the cross-dressing stuff that pops in from time to time, just these odd little weird things that Ed Wood cannot help himself but include. That's what makes these movies go from just a standard B movie to an Ed Wood movie.
And what happens now is people want to put in references to horror movies. He was putting in references to things that he was interested in.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with film.
One of my favorite stories I heard, I'm sure Paul knows the story, maybe you do too, Rebecca, but there was a you know, the first day that Stephen Apostoloff, who later on did, you know, I think Orgy of the Dead and other stuff with Ed, the first day he met him, he was at a bar and he was supposed to meet he's supposed to meet Ed Wood there, and he shows up in a dress, you know, like in a, you know, skirt and stuff and Angora sweater and all that stuff and with a wig, and was like, hey, I'm Ed Wood. He was like, are you kidding me? Like, who is this guy? You know? And I can just see that on his sets. Like, he just shows up and wears these cross dresses because that's just how he is, you know?
Right,
he didn't care at all, you know? Like, all he cared about was, A, making movies, you know, which was his passion and his love, and wearing women's clothes.
Unfortunately, alcohol. That's the dark side that leads to a much darker story, which we've talked about this before. Much as I love Ed Wood, it only focuses on the light, happy, positive stuff, and it does not go down that very dark road that, unfortunately, he takes with himself and his family and his career. And it's
when we did Orgy of the Dead on a sexploitation sleazecast, asterisk. Go listen. Like I said, is that how you want to be remembered? Like, don't you want, like, if you are going to be remembered for something, don't you want to be remembered for like that passion and that gusto? You don't want to be remembered for like your like days in the gutter.
It would have been a 4-hour movie, because already that movie was like 2 hours long.
Sure.
So absolutely. They could have put stuff about jailbait into it. There was some interesting shit that happened during jailbait that I read about. There could have been some interesting other stuff from other things, but they concentrate, or Night of the Ghouls. There was some really, we've talked about on the podcast in the first season, about some really interesting stories I read about working on that movie. And
it's fascinating, his whole thing.
Yeah, the whole, like, because that was his dark time. That was his time where he was starting to like lose it as a, you know, as a filmmaker, because he felt like nobody cared about him, you know, right? So the fact that they leave it kind of where he felt like he was on top at that time because he had a good screening of Plan 9, you know, and what I really like about it is he ends with him not caring that the top's down, and he's just like, let's just go and drive, because that was just how he was, you know. And it just shows us, then they go into the ending thing where it talks about Ed Wood or all the people that are part of his crew and everything, and it does sort of mention that he alcoholism and nudie cuties were his, like, kind of his downfall at the end of his life. But, like, you know, we interviewed this season, we got to interview Fred Olin Ray, and we did ask him about Ed Wood, because, yeah, we interviewed Fred Olin Ray. Because
we rock, baby, earlier. We rock.
And yeah, you didn't invite me.
I don't know. I don't know why we didn't invite you. We should have. But, you know, we interviewed him. We asked him about, because he had actually worked with Ed, you know, briefly. So, you know, and I just, anybody who's still alive and can give me any information about Ed, I freaking die for. Like, when I met Conrad Brooks, I was in heaven, you know, and everything. I couldn't, unfortunately, talk to him for very long. But, you know, he was a great guy. And Ed, everybody loved Ed, you know. Like, there was no, even though he didn't make great movies or whatever, there was no, like, nobody hated him or anything, you know, or right. As a person. He was a very lovable person.
Right. And the thing is, okay, just going back, I don't want to harp on the same point, but, like, if you die, don't you want to be remembered for the thing you were passionate about? You don't want to be remembered for your foibles and for the bad divorces or alcoholism and all that shit.
I see that point. On the other hand, there's something to be said for balance. There's something to be said for truth. There's something to be said for the complete story. Now, I'm not saying all of that should have been in Ed Wood.
Could there be another one? Right. Could there be something else?
It should be something separate. And I have always said that would be a fascinating and wonderful movie to sort of go into that. But Ed Wood was fine by itself. Didn't need to go beyond where it was. I was happy.
Well, they are planning that, by the way. They were at one point. John Keyes has a script. I don't know if he's ever going to make it or not. Unfortunately, the funding did not go through for it, but there's a script about Ed Wood and his last days when he was about to die.
Hold
on. Let me get to, like, that's not the story. The story is at the end in the book, Nightmare of Ecstasy, they talk about the last day he looked up into the sky and he saw he saw something, right? He was looking up at the ceiling and something was like looked like it was coming after him. The idea of like what was he looking at and what was going on through his brain is what the story was about, I believe. And I think that's an interesting story, especially if you do start it off with talking about kind of the depressing kind of thing, because I was kind of see that, because I, when I read about it, I was like, wow, they don't really discuss that in Ed Wood as
sure. Far as sure. That. And here's the thing too. In order to make that really, really work, you have to make this sort of a tragic figure. And what is better, more tragic figure than some that you've already previously lionized? You don't have to worry about building this person up so that you care about them. We already care about Ed Wood because he was such a nice guy and he was so innocent and he had all these wonderful dreams and he tried. And just, you know, the circumstances just didn't work out for him. And it's great that we got to see all that stuff beforehand, but now the other shoe, and it just makes it a lot more heart-wrenching, and it makes it more powerful mm-hmm. statement, in my opinion. It's just, it needs to be done right. What we don't want is for somebody raking up a bunch of shit and just, you know, ha, 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 look at this loser, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean?
I guess that was my point. Like, it needs to be, like, very respectful.
Right. It could be abused if it's not done right.
Yeah. Well, obviously, the person who does that movie or whatever, like John Keyes, if he does do it, obviously, he has a love for Ed Wood because, obviously, he knows that information about Ed, you know, and stuff like that. So people are going to make a movie. There's another movie being made at some point. I think it was called Ed and the Living Dead or something. And it's going to be directed by Brandy Mason. So I'm hoping that they get that movie off the ground.
It didn't get its funding. Actually, Jason Crow is supposed
playing
to be
Ed, right?
And will do a great job if it ever gets
Well, are they still planning to make it? Do you know?
They didn't make their funding. I think they're going to try again.
Okay. Well, I will give some money to them because can't wait for that movie to get made.
And raise your hand out there if you would like to see a remake of Bride of the Monster.
Sadly, you can't right now. Somebody actually owns the rights to that movie of all his freaking movies. The one I want to have be remade.
Right.
Somebody owns the rights to it, and I don't think that they're planning to actually, to make that or anything. Or I'm sure if Hollywood came in and said, hey, well,
why not make an unofficial one and just call it Bride of the Atom?
You could do that, I guess, because somebody was going to do a remake to, I think maybe they did, I don't know, but they were going to do a remake to Plan 9, other than John Johnson, who did do a remake to Plan 9, but they were going to call it the original title, which was Grave Robbers from Outer Space.
I can get a Goodwill wedding dress. I might be way fatter. But if you need
do you want to play Janet Lawton?
If you need a plucky journalist,
I will shave my head and become Lobo.
That's actually perfect. Yes. I think I can see you as Lobo.
Leave the mustache.
Oh my goodness.
That'd be hilarious.
Instead of a swatch, I'll just keep the monkey with me and pet him.
Yeah.
That's funny. I like that.
He has
That's
a squeaky
good.
Sock monkey, because this isn't a visual for everybody.
I would totally, totally be your Lobo.
Notice, Rebecca, she said your Lobo.
My Lobo.
There you go.
Well, Lobo does save the girl in a way. Yeah. You know?
Lobo is the hero. He is the anti-hero. Right?
Yeah.
But I mean, let me retract that a little bit. He's not the anti-hero. He is seen as the monster just because of his stature and his demeanor, but he really doesn't do anything bad. He really doesn't.
Right. And it's funny because he ends up being the hero when it's really supposed to be set up so that the cop is, Janet Lawton's fiance is supposed to be the hero.
Right.
And 9 times out of 10, it would be that guy, but he gets his ass kicked royally backwards and forwards all the time. He's
oh
not
my
terrible,
god.
He's the worst hero ever.
He is.
And
he
that sucks. Really kind of fits with Ed Wood. he can't even write a good hero.
No, but I like that the Lawson girl ends up being tougher than her fiance. So
that's true. Her fiance is down on the ground and she's actually, up and running around. Mm-hmm. So
I hear you. What did she say? I hear you. I something like that. I understand what you're saying. I just don't hear you.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I heard what you said. I just can't hear you.
Right. Something like that.
which is ridiculous. And
again, the sarcasm that drips from her mouth. I just love it. I love it.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is that was written for Dolores Fuller to play, who ends up playing the other girl. And they just decided to go with this other girl because they thought she had money. And she didn't have the money that they thought she had.
Reportedly.
Yeah, she reportedly said she did. But from what I've actually looked into, she didn't actually have any money. Period. She had told him she had something, or whatever, but didn't, whatever. So it's just really strange that he was actually thought, oh man, here's going to be the woman who's going to fund my movie. And then, and then, so they actually did do it for 3 days in that studio. Then all of a sudden, it kind of failed. They had to go get more money, had to go get Tony McCoy's father, Donald McCoy, who I don't even know how he found him. He just, I guess somehow or another just found, how else does other people find investors in this,
You walk around and you beg people.
Yeah.
He was a
salesman.
If
anyone has the answer to this, please DMV. Yes.
We would love
if Ed Wood had real skills, it was being a salesman. he managed to talk his way into people giving him money, not all that he wanted, but enough to get things made. He managed to talk people into being in his films. So really, if he you know, could have been a salesman, he probably would have been a very successful salesman.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I agree. So I think we're getting to the ending thing. I'm not sure exactly. But Paul, why don't you explain to everybody at home about the stinkometer that we have there?
Well, first I have to say that he tampered in God's domain.
Yes.
and then I'm going to say, as far as the stinkometer goes, this is our way of rating our films for the season. We use a 1-10 rating system by which we are really counting up how much stink there is. So the higher the score, the more stink. You might give a 1 if you think that it is very not much stink at all. You might give it a 5 if it's in between. And if you think it's a whole big barrel of crappy stink, you might give it a 10. And if you feel, you know, subtle about it, you could go a half step, 5.5, 6.5, that sort of thing. And then at the end of the season, we count up all the scores and we figure out what was the stinkiest movie of the season.
Which we're going to do soon. So that's going to be fun. But okay, so Paul, we never have you go first. I want you to go first. I have an idea what I'm going to rate it, but I want to hear your rating first.
Okay, well, given the fact that Plan 9 and Glenda Glenda are both 10s for me, I would say, even though we haven't done those movies on our show yet.
Yet.
This movie is not nearly like that. It's mm-hmm. still pretty bad. There's still a lot of bad crap to it. I would probably go ahead and give it an 8.
Wow, an 8. All right. That's funny because that's exactly what I was going to give it too. So,
oh, okay.
I'm wondering if our special guest is going to give it the same rating.
Or lower.
So what about it, Rebecca?
I hate the scale, by the way, because like,
we get that all the time.
Oh, stinky is good to me. Like, yeah. But no, on this one, it's right down the middle. I'm going to go to 5 because I think this has super legit movie legitimacy. Okay, redundant. But yeah, it is still Ed Wood. It is still like a sci-fi movie. It is, you know, still cheesy. But I guess if I have to go on your scale, okay. And I would say it's right down the middle. Like, I still don't feel like this is a super stinky, weird movie. I just don't.
No, I agree, but I'm not gonna lie, originally I was thinking 5 too, you know, but Paul kind of pointed out a lot of problems with this movie that I didn't even think about, you know, until he pointed it out, that made me think that it's an 8 to me. Like, it's just, it's like, it's higher in stink, but it's actually still, I mean, it's a decent movie. It's not a 10 or something like that. It's not nearly as incompetent as, you know, even the funniest thing about Ed Wood, the movie Ed Wood, was like, they showed the him going, you know, bumping into stuff. I didn't see that in the movie, like in the, mm-hmm. in the actual movie, he doesn't like bump into something and then walk in, you know, like.
Here's the irony to what you just said, is I probably would have given this a little bit higher score, but some of the things that Paul said actually legitimize, just like the monster thing. Cause I was like, the monster, octopus, well, the whole idea that it is the doctor, like, oh, mm-hmm. like that just, it legitimized it so much.
That blew your mind?
I won't say that it blew my mind, but it definitely took my mind down from octopus to human, and that helped.
Well, it's interesting because even though I think Plan 9 and Glenda Glenda are worse films, I enjoy them and probably enjoy them a little bit more than I enjoy this film. Whereas, say, Night of the Ghouls is a movie that I don't enjoy as much. I just don't think it's as fun as this film or any of the other ones there. And it is a worse movie. So I tend to give that a higher score, even though it's not
as
much
fun. We
give that
a 9.
Yeah.
See, that's the problem with this scale to me. It's like Plan 9. Plan 9 actually, upon watching it as a 44-year-old me, I watched it twice for a certain show that I'm doing. And I was like, I just don't think this is as bad as I used to think it was. Now, Glenn or Glenda, I enjoy more. But it would get a higher stink score. So I'm just so conflicted by this scale.
Well, part of the problem is that, you know, initially when we did this score, we had regular people with us too. People who don't quite love stinky movies the same way we do. So you have people like Just Jen and Lenore and some of the other folks who are looking at these things and thinking, these are movies you guys like.
I'm not the co-host on that.
Yeah, we have to get past our score bias a little bit. Because even though I love movies, I still recognize the fact that these are poorly made. You know, and so that's why I'm going
to rate. This one is not as nearly poorly made as most of Ed Wood's movies. So if you have to rate it, like, okay, you had to rate it on an Ed Wood scale. I mean, this would be like a 1 or 2.
Yeah. Well, right, but if you look at it in the realm of like stinky movies, this is a pretty stinky movie. I mean, like, I agree with Paul on that. And, but
I don't know. Okay.
Gang up on her.
But see, that's the thing that I like having her around, because she does kind of point out these like things of like, she's going to be a little bit different than we are about it, because she looks at this like, well, this isn't that bad of a movie. It is the bad movie. Right. It's a terrible
movie. I think there's a little bit of the movie maker inside you too, saying, let's cut him up a little bit of a break, because I know what it's like.
I know, but I also think that like, okay, so I just one more time, I'm going to reiterate this and I'm going to let it go. So when I first started getting into Ed Wood movies, I worked at a video store that was a cult video store. And it was like all just like, I mean, I just watched Russ Meyer, Herschel Gordon Lewis, Ed Wood, like all freaking day. And I had no customers. I ate Pop-Tarts. I didn't get paid, like literally, like I had to take the boss to work.
There's a movie right there, by the way.
But I ate Pop-Tarts, fell asleep on a little couch watching The Twilight Zone every day. Okay, if I had made more than $600 in an entire summer, it would have been awesome. However, I did get to watch all these movies. And like, when it came down to it, okay, I told you Orgy of the Dead. Like, I started watching that and I was like, this is dumb. This is lame. You know? But like, watching Bride of the Monster, I was like, this is pretty good.
Right.
You know? Like,
fair enough.
Right. I mean, it wasn't even like a comparative thing. It was like, okay, if this is this filmmaker and this is where he's gone, yeah, this ain't no Glenn or Glenda, guys.
I agree. And that's why I only give it, you know, an 8 as opposed to a higher number. But
right. Yeah. We all have different levels in our heads.
I see where you're coming from.
Well, no. But, and I think that's an interesting thing, too, because Paul did a thing on our review, our indiefilmcafe.reviews. Go check it out. But he's done a new thing called the Ladder of Stink. And he shows where each, you know, movie is on like the scale, right? So there'd be like ones that are 30, there'd be ones that are 29, 28,
all of them
whatever.
We've done.
All of them that we've done so far. And honestly, up here, if we do the way that we're doing it, it's going to be what, 21, you know? A 21 is pretty good.
Modestly.
As average.
Stink. Right.
You know, it's average. Like, it's stinky, but it's not, you know, it's not like Rat Think a Boo Boo, which everybody likes, you know.
Right. So it works out in the end.
But it's also not like so tame you shouldn't watch it. And that's the other thing I don't want to like pigeonhole this movie into. I don't want people to think, oh, so this is just a normal movie.
Right. Well, that's why hopefully they listen to us talking.
They don't, but that's okay.
Well, no, but if they see our ratings, they see 8.8 and, you know, and 5, they'll see that, they'll look at that and go, okay, then maybe there's conflicting things and feelings about this.
Yeah, and they're going to say, who's the freak who who lowballed it?
Who's the dumb bitch who actually thought this was a decent movie?
No. But I'm going to say, Rebecca, that description that you said about your summer watching stinky movies and eating Pop-Tarts, that's your Clerks right there. You got to make that movie.
Okay, I know we're at our time, but I do have to tell you one additional story about the summer. So, okay, that is the guy who owned the video store in my town where I watched all those movies. Like, you know, that's where I learned about Sleepaway Camp, Friday the 13th, freaking Flesh-Eating Mothers, like everything. He was really into horror. And then he had opened a cult video store, basically took all the horror stuff, went to Bloomington, which is like the college town. It is called Plan 9 Video, appropriately.
Nice.
Yeah, and I went away to college for a year, came back for a summer, and he had that store, and I ended up working there. Again, I did not really get my money. I did not get anything. But I got an education, and it was across the street from, like, this, this, like, record store, and I would trade the guy like weed for like movies, and he had a laser disc player. It was super awesome. Like, and I said, like, I had this little fold out couch. I would just totally take a nap. Nobody would come in for like an hour and a half. But he was evading taxes, and one day I did have a couple of FBI agents.
Oh my gosh.
I wanted to look at the whole inventory, and I was like, okay, here you go. You know, and he's like, why did you show him that? I'm like, dude, I got like fucking FBI agents, and I'm eating Pop-Tarts and not getting paid. I'm going to show the FBI agents your fucking inventory, dude.
Oh my God. That is your Clerks. You need to shoot that
film. It is.
Real quick, I want to tell you a quick story real quick that apparently I used to work at a video store as well called Movie Scene. It was originally called Video Update. I used to work at it, and the guy that worked with me worked at a record store in Williamsburg called Plan 9. And we have a Plan 9 record store. So it's really funny. Like, me and you kind of, you know, have a similar...
Circular.
And while I never worked at a video store, my fantasy was always to have a cult, a horror cult, you know, video store. Even today, I would love to open that up, a retro store where people could come in and rent DVDs and Blu-rays and even VHS tapes. All stinky movies and horror movies and B-movies.
Like the place that I worked, I wish, and I think that was part of it. I really wish that it had, had a ground. But it was in like that transition phase. People weren't like renting movies.
Well, I think it's about time that we're done. But thank you so much, Rebecca. You have a bunch of podcasts that you do. Tell us which ones that people need to check out.
So my main podcast is In the Mic of Madness. You can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. My YouTube channel is not quite Final Girl, but the thing that people really love that I do is drunken commentaries. So basically my little rat terrier Snickers and I watch movies and I drink and I just comment over movies. So if you don't even go to Not Quite Final Girl, if you just like do drunken commentaries on YouTube, you'll find me. I've done The Burning, Young Frankenstein. I actually have had some human co-hosts in my last few. Amazing. Like, I actually branched out to other people. But yeah, find me there. And I'm on Facebook, Rebecca Reinhart, Rineart. How you spell it?
Okay. And she's also on a bunch of podcasts with us. She does Sexploitation Sleaze Cast with with Paul. She also does was it
84.
Well, there's also real quick before that one, there's also another one, Paul, which Forgotten Horror Classics does as well. And then 80s horror horror films with myself, Julianne, Joe, and Mackenzie sometimes. So
And we are gonna do Christmas Evil next week. So if you want a drug fueled Christmas movie, listen to that one.
I'm excited. I have not actually seen that, so it's gonna be.
Wait, you still haven't seen it? You still haven't seen it? Oh my god!
I haven't watched it yet. No. I'm watching it before. Like, I like to watch it the day of or the day before, so it's fresh in my mind. But
I am really excited now.
I am excited too. I can't wait to talk about it.
And we are gonna be bringing back Forgotten Horror Classics, and you know, with Lenora not being around, there's places wide open for another co-host. So I know you came in for the one show, so we'd love to have you back for more.
I'm here. Just me, my kitchen table.
Pause there. I was a little worried.
I'm here.
But awesome. Yeah, no. So we'll have those back. And also this Saturday, we are filming, or we're recording the Paul's episode, last episode of the season, and we are also filming the recap as well. So it's going to be a busy, busy like Christmas time, you know, and everything back here in Williamsburg. So I'm very excited just to be back with everybody.
Yeah, just like Santa's elves, we are going to be busy in the workshop putting out content for all our fans out there.
I mean, even though the COVID hit, 2020 has been a pretty damn good year, I say, you know, for our podcast at least.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're still putting out content. We're not stopping, you know.
Right. And we have Rebecca joining us, and that's been a big, huge, massive plus.
I sent her a message the other day.
Always here to talk.
I sent her a message about that, and I think she thought I was drunk or something, because she was like, what the hell? You know, but I was just gushing about it because, like, she really has, out of all the people that we've had, you've stepped up and really helped us out a lot, and we really appreciate it.
We've been gushing, man. We're gushing all over you, both of us, at the same time.
Well, we'll gush on Sunday with Sexploitation.
Yeah, you guys gush over that. All right.
Sounds good. It's a gusher.
Paul, what do you have going on as I divert the conversation?
Well, you know, not a lot much other than work. But apart from, my Indie Film Cafe and then Sexploitation Sleaze Cast. And I guess we can let the cat out of the bag about the new program we're talking about. Which, again, if you're interested, you could be part of. But we're starting a new video review monthly show coming out that I call Blue Cheese. And it's going to be Stinky Movies on Blu-ray. So that should be fun.
I think it's
going
to be mainly Paul because, I mean, it's just I'm so fucking busy with a million podcasts. If I can fit in one or two movies that I can do, I'll do it. But I think Paul's mainly, this is going to be Paul's baby. You know, he did the theme song. He did the logo. So I'm really like, Paul, run it, you know, do it. Cause we need, he needs to do more stuff on the YouTube. I've been doing way too much.
Slacker.
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
Paul.
Stupid regular job I have to do in order to get money, in order to not be living in a
Jesus.
Box.
What's wrong with you? You know, I just want to say once again, thank you, Rebecca. You were awesome. And
absolutely.
Check us out. We've still got a lot of different podcasts going on. I mean, if you looked at our schedule for next month in January, we're going to have like a lot of podcasts going. We're going to have one, you know, three podcasts a week, and that's going to be a lot going on.
Right.
We're trying to make 2021 just as amazing as 2020, maybe even more. I want to keep it going because, and then also one of the ideas that we're having is like Paul and I are going to be back since we're going to have Zoom, are going to be doing podcasts together, but we're also going to be doing like stuff where we, you know, interview or we have other people on the show as well. So he'll have, you know, people around him or whatever, sometimes at the studio and sometimes through Zoom. So, you know, it's going to be a crazy year.
Should be fun.
No.
The monkey is ready.
The monkey is ready. My monkey is in my room.
And you that's know. Where it shall stay.
And good night.
Good night. Bye, right. Everybody. We love you.
We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye. On this computer.
Yeah, we're not going to be too fancy. We are recording.
Outstanding.
Yeah, there's one of each of us. It's perfect.
I know. Oh, I thought right, I had to do it on arm. There, but every hey, time yes. I did it, I just, yeah. All right, so I guess we'll start. All right.
Yeah.
This will be added extra for
it'll
the
be a fun blooper reel.
I know.